Hi, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians.
And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are back and today we are here in Adelaide to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to season two of our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we conduct intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians and other victims of the research bug.
We talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them and when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating or most illuminating experience in the archives.
And we ask the question, what madness is this? Today on Archive Fever, we're speaking to environmental historian Dr. Alessandro Antonello, who's currently a senior research fellow at Flinders University in Adelaide. Alessandro, also known as Sandro, could be described as a historian of water and ice. He's an expert in the history of Antarctica, and his first book, called The Greening of Antarctica, Assembling an International Environment, was published by Oxford University Press in 2019. He's currently working on the history of the Southern Ocean and has also written on ice cores, ice sheets and glaciers. In short, he's taking the fever out onto the ice. Welcome to Archive Fever, Sandro.
I'm so happy to be here.
Let's go back to where it all began. How did you first get the fever for Antarctica?
It was a very slow development of fever, I think. When I was an undergraduate, I discovered this thing called environmental history. I thought I was being a normal old historian working on colonial Australian history, history of Australian Federation, those kinds of questions. And a professor I had, Anne Curthoys, in Indigenous history, suggested, oh, you might be interested in this thing called environmental history. And we have a few of those at ANU, where I did my undergraduate degree. Let me put you in contact with Tom Griffiths. And so then I think I was a second, you know, young, fresh-faced second year undergraduate, and I went over to meet Tom Griffiths. And I learnt about this thing called environmental history, and the rest is history. At the time, I was more interested in Australian history of the continent itself, and I did my honours degree on drought in Australia, in New South Wales, to be exact. At the time, though, Tom was also working on the history of Antarctica. His book, Slicing the Silence, I think came out in 2007 or 2008. And so simply being told by someone, I'm working on the history of Antarctica, it's like, oh, there's the history to Antarctica. I'm sure Tom has had that thought a lot, and I certainly have had faced that question since. And so that, you know, meshed with a generic sort of background of knowledge of Australian history that most Australians will have, you know, Douglas Mawson on the $100 note growing up. And I started to do a little digging, not for any course, just out of interest. One of the benefits of studying at ANU is that you have the National Library of Australia and the National Archives of Australia right at your fingertips. And then I was looking at the collection of a man called Philip Law, who was the director of Australia's Antarctic expeditions in the 1950s and 1960s. His papers are kept at the National Library. And there was a folder in there with written on the front something like, this man was the most knowledgeable man of Antarctica who ever lived. Something like that. That man's name was Brian Roberts, a strange figure, a strange British figure who worked at Cambridge and in the Foreign Office for most of his career. And he was such an intriguing enough figure that it did quite hook me in. I imagine him to be working in sort of some dingy London basement collating knowledge about the Antarctic. And I've been interested ever since in Antarctica. And Brian Roberts is, in fact, in my book, The Greening of Antarctica.
So you've gone full circle.
Indeed.
So, you know, when we hear that someone's a historian of Antarctica, we might immediately think of, you know, going to the place of Antarctica and investigating it on the ground. But you've just talked about how your sort of fever for Antarctica started at the National Library and the National Archive of Australia, more conventional state-run archives. Have you been to Antarctica at all, or has your research been confined to these more conventional archives?
Well, I think research is never confined to an archive. I only just recently went to Antarctica for the first time. So I started my PhD in 2010, and this earlier research began a few years before that. And so, yes, it took until 2020 for me to get to Antarctica. So this summer I went on a large tourist cruise ship. I was there in a sort of official capacity. observing the cruise to see that it was environmentally sound and safe for the passengers. These are dangerous waters, and there are very strict international and national regulations around that. It was fascinating to be there, as you can imagine. Mm. Part of my approach to Antarctic history so far has been to ask, how did all of these people who actually never went to Antarctica govern it? Mm. How did they think about it? How did they talk about it over the negotiating table? This is a place with a complex territorial history. Seven countries claim a territory there, but most other countries don't recognise those claims. And so over the course of Antarctica's history, which goes back to the late 18th century with sealers and whalers, but in the sort of most numerous sense, you know, most people have been to Antarctica since 1945, these diplomats around the world have been talking about this place, many of whom have never even went there. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's on the first few pages of my book that I observe that there were 99 delegates to the Antarctic Treaty Conference in 1959. I think only five of them had actually been to Antarctica. A few had gone to the Arctic as well, so, you know, a bit of ice there. But actually going there has made me appreciate, this sounds completely ridiculous that I would just realise this on this trip, but it really does emphasise to you the nature of the place, this place which I am an environmental historian of. I don't think it was so necessary for me to go there for this book, for my investigations of the diplomatic history of Antarctica, but with some new work I'm doing on the Southern Ocean, particularly trying very slowly to write a biography of a krill biologist who worked there, I saw the place she worked. I was in the waters that she worked in. And so I think that was very important for me.
Sandro, a lot of historians talk about the first time that they get to be in situ in the place that they have studied. Of course, you know, many of us, we can't go back to medieval Rome or fin de siècle Paris, but completely. Actually being in the city might do something to you that changes your understanding of the place that you have studied. I want to actually take you back to the archives in Canberra before you'd seen the ice and experienced the environment yourself. And have you explained to us what archive fever feels like for you? Because you've said there was 10 years in the archives before you actually were able to see the place that you'd been studying. How do you experience it? Does it burn hot for you? Or because you're reading about Antarctica, does your blood run cold?
Well, my archive fever, of course, predates my Antarctic interests. When I was an undergraduate, I also was a summer scholar at the National Archives. And so I worked there for a summer, going through files for a sort of biographically focused project for the National Archives. I was reminiscing last night, preparing for this podcast, something I'd forgotten for years, that my Year 9 work experience had an archival element. This makes me seem like the biggest nerd on earth. But I worked in my local parish in the archives there, very small little archives, but, you know, in a Catholic parish, if you're baptised somewhere, when you get married later, the priest will send a note to the place you were baptised and the baptismal register is updated. So, in fact, when I was a nerdy little Year 9 student, I was doing such archival work.
I did my work experience at Young Talent Time answering Joey Peroni's correspondence. So, yeah, you have out-nerded us, Sandro, for sure.
For me, the archival fever is actually tenacious and decade or more than decade long. I'm always excited to get back into an archive. I love a 9-to-5 day in the archive. When you're working with official documents, perhaps unlike, let's say, someone's personal collection that has been donated to a library, that you know it's always going to be like that. When you're fighting with the National Archives of Australia for access examination, you can be waiting years to see a file. You do have to publish in the interim. I still have access examination requests going back to 2010 that I'm waiting for.
That's still really deferred gratification. I want to see that dopamine hitting your brain cells when you finally get those documents handed over.
Well, indeed, the problem is once you've looked at enough files, the ones that are finally released don't quite hit the, you know, they don't quite satisfy you as much as they might otherwise. For me, it's really about collecting stories, collecting fine-grained details over years to construct a worldview, because the archive doesn't just contain information for us to tell our stories. It was used by the people I am writing about. It was part of their daily life to use these files, to put cables and memoranda and letters and drafts on these files. And so they stack up on these, you know, rusty, dangerous pins. In Australia, they're pins. At the National Archives in Britain, they're much safer sort of tie strings. The actual physical archive is what they were using. It's not simply what records information that can go into the story. It was essential for them. And so actually to flip through these files, to think about how does this file relate to this other file? I got a file out last year, took a few years to open. The title was about ice and the Antarctic. Totally my jam. I opened it and I was reading through it and it was all cables from Canada, from the Australian Embassy in Canada, about Arctic ice. And I'm like, what the hell? Why does the title not match the contents? But then it occurred to me, of course, that this file was being used by people at the time to think about ice in Antarctica. And just because it didn't actually contain information about that very specific topic, the actual architecture of the file, the fact that this file sat next to other files, meant that it was part of their thinking. And so that really just keeps me going, thinking about all these files in a row. You know, they're not always on the desks of your historic actors. They're, you know, filed away or obscured somehow. But that sort of collective knowledge, that collective material that they use, not just to put information out of sight, but to remember with, that keeps me going.
Sandro, it's clear that a lot of your work on Antarctica has involved bureaucratic archives, which perhaps have a reputation for not being the most exciting archives in the world. You know, the stereotype is that they might be a bit kind of dull and procedural, but you clearly are really intoxicated by them.
Absolutely.
Is it the kind of process of seeing what we might call the official mind generate knowledge that excites you? And have you also found sort of unexpected, perhaps a bit saucy kind of moments in the bureaucratic archive?
You often find little jokes in the archive, which is very good. One of my favourite is in the 1950s, when Australian diplomats learnt that the Soviets were dragging a bust of Lenin around the Antarctic, they suggested that perhaps they should have a bust of the Australian Foreign Minister, Richard Casey, made to also drag around the Antarctic. And so little quips like that, I mean, they're a bit droll, they're a bit white man, but, you know, they're throughout the archive. For me, in fact, thankfully, diplomats are among the more interesting bureaucrats on this earth. Australians, a little less than their counterparts in other countries, are a bit more staid in their writing, but British diplomats are famed for the competition between them about who can write the most interesting dispatches and the most interesting memoranda. A great book a few years ago, British diplomats, when they leave a post, as many diplomats do, write a valedictory cable. And some of them are just side-splittingly funny, often trading in hideous national and racial stereotypes, but others to do with the ridiculous situations that diplomats very often get into. Australian diplomats aren't sometimes as funny as their British or, dare I say, even Kiwi counterparts.
Sandro, this history is very much written on the archives of diplomats, which might seem to be very dry, but ultimately the place that you're writing about is dripping wet, or more precisely, frozen solid. So you've written a history of the Antarctic ice sheet, which, you know, as we know, is the largest body of ice in the world. How do you go about researching the history of ice? Does ice have an archival DNA of its own?
Ice is an excellent archive for the Earth. My research on the history of the Antarctic ice sheet was done alongside research trying to understand the history of glaciology, so the science that studies ice. So after I completed my geopolitical, diplomatic, environmental history of the Antarctic Treaty, my first job after my PhD was working on a larger project on the history of ice, the way humans think about ice and they relate to ice, and specifically the history of glaciology. It's a great challenge. Ice is so, especially the Antarctic ice sheet, is so bloody huge and inhuman, so antithetical to human life, and in its size, dwarfs everything. I'm not the first person to observe this. There's a wonderful book by Stephen Pine, more famous as a historian of fire, but one of his earliest books was on Antarctica, and he really, I think, essays this inhuman Antarctic ice very well. So in trying to think of the history of the Antarctic ice sheet, I was always struggling about how these puny little humans came to grips with this huge thing. That was, in fact, the entry point of trying to understand this history. How do humans understand giant earthly things? The Antarctic ice sheet is one of them. The Greenland ice sheet, obviously another. The oceans, other things like that. But the ice, of course, is its own archive. It archives the Earth's atmosphere. And in fact, when we think about non-paper archives, archives that humans haven't made, we really, I think, can crack open what it means to write history, what history is. So let me give you an example. So ice is formed from snow, which falls every year in summer and winter. And because Antarctica is so cold, it doesn't melt. So it forms layers. And over tens of thousands, indeed hundreds of thousands of years, like a tree ring, every year is recorded. And every year contains proxy data about the temperature on Earth at the time that the snow fell, which became the ice. So in Antarctica, the oldest ice core is over 800,000 years old. And at the moment, scientists from many countries are trying to find one over 1 million years old. So this tells us about the Earth, but how does it tell us about humans? Well, there's an ice core that's been drilled in Australia's Antarctic Territory from a place called Law Dome. So Law Dome is like a mini ice sheet just off the main Antarctic ice sheet, fairly separated. So it's like a cone that flows outwards on all sides. And in the middle, Australian scientists have drilled a core that goes back over 10,000 years. It's called a high-resolution core because the layers are thicker. Now, around the year 1600, roughly, after the Spanish invasion of South America and the death that resulted through active genocide or through disease, the Amazon rainforest, in fact, began to regrow because there were fewer people there to take care of the rainforest, to burn it, to use it, just like Indigenous Australians did on this continent. Because the rainforest regrew, it took down carbon from the atmosphere, and that dip is clear in the Law Dome ice core, which has been drilled by Australian scientists. So I think when we look at the ice as an archive, we can think, how does this make us rethink Antarctic history? It makes us rethink, where is the human in Antarctic history? We always like to talk about James Cook being the first to cross the Antarctic Circle, which indeed he was with his two ships, sure. But what about this clearly suggest to us that maybe colonization, which is still an active theme in Antarctic history, pushes it back. It makes us think about the human in Antarctica. It also makes us think about just global environmental history as well, the deep connections between the continents, the connections of the atmosphere, and how apparently local events have global environmental effects.
I'm never going to think about those little ice cubes in my freezer that go into the gin and tonic the same way ever again.
Well, in the 1950s, when they began to drill ice cores, both in Greenland and Antarctica, the US military, which was really the prime backer of these things in the 1950s, would serve journalists ice core ice in their scotch or whatever they served, usually probably Coca-Cola, the sort of wowser Americans, served journalists ice core ice in their drinks in the 1950s.
That is extraordinary. Like, hang on.
They were eating or drinking the archive,
indeed.
Literally.
Drinking the archive.
Did they transport it back, like in little freezer bags?
Absolutely, yeah. Ice cores are still transported back with great difficulty because you can't let them melt at all, obviously. You have to transport them back to these archival repositories. There's a very big one in Colorado, for example, where the US stores all of its
ice cores. Oh, so there actually is a physical archive of ice.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Oh, this is blowing my mind. You know,
very, very cold, you know. You have to have excellent generators because the moment they begin melting, you've destroyed the scientific quality of the specimen. It's very hard work to keep these archives frozen and in pristine state.
Speaking of melting ice, we all know that the Antarctic ice sheet is itself melting. You know, I think it strikes me that's one of the fascinating things about your research, that you're studying things that are kind of literally disappearing before our eyes. I really loved this sentence you wrote in one of your articles saying, "The once seemingly solid and immutable body of ice is now a fragile and precious one, a body with a diminished future." I'm really intrigued by how you understand the relationship between your sort of research on the histories of ice and Antarctica in particular and how we use this kind of scientific data about ice to think about the future, and particularly the quite frightening future that's unfolding as we speak due to the changing climate. How do historians like you contribute to kind of understandings of the climate crisis, do you think?
It's a really hard question. I think all historians are very diffident about talking about the future, quite rightly. I try and take a slightly modest view of this. I think feminist ethics, feminist science technology studies of the last few decades have told us to perhaps be a bit more modest about our knowledge claims. And I'll try and be modest in this sense, that I think in a sort of history of science perspective that I often take with my work, that it helps us to understand how we know what we know and what we might not know. And I think that's important with the climate crisis, to the extent that it's about reassuring people that the science we have of the climate system is rigorous, and it's decades old, many decades old, in fact. You know, one of its strengths is that it has persisted and has been refined over decades, that there's been ample opportunity to falsify it, to use a sort of archaic idea of the way scientific knowledge works, and to, you know, keep collecting data and to keep refining ideas about how the climate actually operates. So that's one element in which I think my work and the work of many colleagues is engaged with the climate crisis. In a less history of science, in a less perhaps technocratic way, one of the ways I think the history I've tried to do, and definitely other colleagues perhaps a bit more successfully than me, is to think about the voices we haven't heard about ice and climatic change and environmental change in general. Who aren't we talking about? Who in fact do have deep histories with these landscapes, but we don't think about when we talk about the climate crisis in public? I was the co-author once of a slightly controversial article, at least in public, which we subtitled A Feminist Glaciology. This idea that the knowledge we have of ice in this world has been gained, it's very good knowledge, but it's been gained through specific systems and by specific people, those systems being European imperialism, US imperialism, and other forms of military and globe-straddling domination. That has given us very good knowledge of the ice sheet, but the structures around that knowledge, I think we can say, are highly problematic. Or we can look back to the 19th century, and we know that certain theories of glaciology in the 19th century were preferred over others because the scientists who had them were better mountaineers. They were seen as greater sportsmen. They were seen as greater outdoorsmen, whilst other forms of knowledge were less privileged because people weren't like that. They didn't conform to these societal stereotypes of what a good scientist or a good glacier person might be.
Are you implying that a good scientist was male?
Never. You know,
I mean, where does the feminist politics in that come in? Were there female glaciologists whose knowledge and experience has been overlooked?
In part, yes. The other important thing for Antarctica is that it took decades for women to be able to actually work there. One of the finest living glaciologists is a British woman who wasn't allowed to go to Antarctica until the early 90s, despite the fact that she was in charge of a scientific section at the British Antarctic Survey in the late 80s.
Why couldn't she go there? Were they worried she was going to bleed on the ice or something?
That's
contamination.
That's usually one of the issues. Toilets are the thread that goes through much of this story. It's like, oh, where will they go to the toilet?
Dig a hole.
Well, in fact, after 1991, there are more complex rules around where you can defecate in Antarctica. So that's another issue. But anyway.
We're going to title this episode Shitting on Ice.
I have my own shitting on ice story in Antarctica.
See what happens when you come into Archives Anonymous?
Indeed. What archive have you left there?
Well, no, it's because I couldn't leave an archive. So I... When I was a teenager, my mother turned 50 and she decided for her 50th birthday she wanted to treat herself and me, by extension, for a trip to Antarctica. So we flew to Argentina and went on a cruise to the Antarctic Peninsula, where Sandro's just returned from. And we were mainly on the cruise ship, but we had an opportunity to spend one night sleeping on the ice in sleeping bags, you know, which seemed like this incredible once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. But they stressed to us that it was very, very important not to leave an archive on the ice, no urination, no defecation allowed. And if it was an absolute emergency and you had to do it, you had to do it in a large tin can on the flat ice in front of the 30 other people sleeping in their sleeping bags. So as a very, very self-conscious, awkward 17-year-old, I thought, no way in hell am I going to risk this. So I sacrificed my contact with Antarctica just so I could retain my modesty, which seems like a terrible decision in retrospect.
Sandro, now that we've gone to some of the places that we've gone to, it's quite clear that something else that a feminist methodology has left us with is exploding of the myth that research and the historian's task is an objective exercise.
Absolutely.
An objective empirical exercise. So let's go to the subjectivity for a moment. I'm interested in the emotional dimension of researching topics that are so closely related to the climate crisis that we've been talking about. We've started to hear psychologists talk about an epidemic of echo anxiety, they call it, or echo grief, and certainly in our young people now, a kind of echo panic as well about the future. Have you been affected by those emotions yourself? Do you need to debrief your time in the archives? Is there any kind of post-traumatic archive syndrome?
Thankfully, I would say no for me. It's clear over the last year or two, especially given the societal pressure coming from underneath, it does start to affect you a bit more. A colleague at the University of Melbourne, the head of geography there, Leslie Head, had an article recently in Science about academics really embracing their emotions in regards to this topic. It's very interesting to work in this area because I don't just go to history conferences, I also sometimes attend scientific conferences, and the major ones for Antarctica are run by the Scientific Committee on Antarctic Research. The last major one 2 years ago, you know, you're in rooms with hundreds of glaciologists who are intricately detailing data and their interpretations of why the West Antarctic ice sheet might collapse in this way, but not in this way. At that meeting 2 years ago, some of the major figures were revising some of their prognostications for the end of the century, which they had only given out 2 years before that, and they were even more dire. Oh, we forgot to include this parameter, or we've just discovered this parameter. But in a really interesting way, and in a sense disconcerting when you look back, the room isn't sort of emotionally charged. It's an incredibly cerebral scientific process for them. There is data. We're going to look at it. We're going to try and understand it. We need to understand what's happened in the past to make predictions about the future, however dire those predictions are. So it seems like parts of the Antarctic, especially the West Antarctic ice sheet, will be contributing tens of centimetres, perhaps over a metre or more, of sea level rise by the end of the century, which is kind of a stunning thing to think about. But when you reflect and think, oh God, why haven't I been more worried about this? You do realise sometimes you can get a bit buried in your research. And I perhaps need to try a bit more, to be a bit more open to that. The subject of this biography I'm trying to write, Mary Alice McWhinney, sort of pioneering woman in Antarctic research, she was a krill biologist. Her letters are just full of her raw emotion about the world, sometimes full of gossip as well, but, you know, her anger at other people down with her in Antarctica. This is the 1960s and 70s when she was very much a rare sight, being a woman down there. So maybe I need to think with my subject, my historical subjects, a bit more.
I'm really fascinated by the relationship between, I suppose, the humanities and science in the kind of Antarctic space. You know, you've just mentioned you're writing a biography of a scientist. A lot of your research has kind of critically interrogated the way scientific knowledge has given meaning to Antarctica. And you've mentioned you also, you know, work along scientists at conferences in the present. How do these two kind of fields of expertise interact in regards to Antarctica today? Do the scientists sort of respect the historians and embrace them? Is there much collaboration, or do they kind of exist fairly separately?
Well, I think there's certainly a numbers imbalance. Mm. We are a tiny community of humanities and social science scholars working in Antarctica, which is fair enough, and there are many, many thousands of scientists working in Antarctica. Some are very open to us, and in fact, the president of the Scientific Committee in Antarctic Research, who's an ecologist, is a great backer of the work we do in the humanities and social sciences. Others have a very conventional view of history. When you say you're a historian, if they're historically literate, they might ask something about Robert Scott or Ernest Shackleton, you know, the great dead white men of Antarctic history. If they're Australian, they might ask about Douglas Mawson. Since they're in Adelaide, I'll put a plug in for Douglas Mawson. Others might think it's far too recent. So I'm a fairly contemporary historian compared to many colleagues. And so actually people will ask, well, is it history? If something happened in the 1980s, is it history? I am, in fact, trying to work with scientists as well around the issue of environmental impact assessment. Now, environmental impact assessment is amongst the most boring environmental regulatory and management tools on this earth, but it's a central regulatory tool that most countries in the world use today. But there's, in fact, a really interesting history of what is impact on the environment. We think it's perhaps self-evident, but in fact, when you look at the history of this regulatory process and this science of assessing impact, we know that some things are assessed and other things aren't. Why was that decision made deliberately or accidentally decades ago? And so I'm trying to work with scientists in Antarctica, which is the only continent where environmental impact assessment is mandatory for every human activity across the whole continent. Including tourist activities. Trying to think with them about how we can look back at the historical record, look at the archive and ask what questions could we be asking that were perhaps dismissed decades ago.
Sandro, you seem like quite a benign type of fellow.
It's the collar, isn't it?
Nicely spoken. But you actually have a claim to fame that most historians can't put on their CV. Your research has been featured, or maybe a better word is attacked, on Fox News. How did you go from sitting quietly in the archive to being the centre of a media storm?
Well, that was quite a furious few weeks in early 2016, actually. My first job after PhD was at the University of Oregon on this project on the history of ice, which I've mentioned. And we published what we thought was a fairly conservative, mostly synthetic piece, looking at the history of glaciology and political ecology and human geography of human ice relations in the last 200 years during modernity. And we gave it the title, I can't even remember my bloody own title anymore, Glaciers, Gender and Science, a Feminist Glaciology Framework for Global Environmental Change. There we are, I think I remembered it. And we thought we were participating in fairly well-worn discussions within human geography and political ecology. And so we put it in. It was in a really great journal, so that was good for my career that it was in a really good journal. And it was out for a few weeks, and then it got picked up by a climate denial website. So the climate denial blogosphere is still fairly strong. And, you know, they just looked at the title and the abstract and thought, oh, this is simply ridiculous. What's next, you know, feminist biology or some, you know, some awful thing like that. How dare they? So then it made the rounds in the climate denial blogosphere. We were getting attacked. And then it sort of started getting a bit more attention through Twitter, through other social media. And so we started to get attacked by various, quite discreet groups of people, some of whom might not have even agreed with each other. So next, I think, as I recall, was what we would call the hardcore scientistic scientists, the people who think that science can do no wrong, that the scientific method is perfect. Like, look at these idiots saying, what's next, you know? Menstruation on ice, is that what feminist glaciology means? Simply ridiculous. And then we started to get attacked by the men's rights activists, amongst the worst people on the internet who think that, you know, the entire world has denigrated men and lifted up women, and they don't deserve to be there. So we started to get attacked by them. And then because I was in the United States and this was being funded by the National Science Foundation, we started to get attacked by Republicans who didn't want science to be funded, or certainly not this kind of scientist.
Not feminist
glaciology. And then there was just the generic ridicule of the internet. People who read the title and a bit of the abstract and thought, oh, this is ridiculous. That happened, I should add, within the space of about 2 weeks. I had three co-authors. We woke up each morning thinking, where will the attack come from today? Really interestingly, and actually this is the serious side of the story, I mean, it's very funny for us now, but the serious side is that the lead author received death threats. There were four authors, two men and two women. I was the third author. I only received one email from a member of the public. The two women, who were not lead authors and did not have their contact details on the paper, were flooded with hate. One of whom had been an undergraduate when the paper was written and was a master's student. Someone sought out her mobile phone number and rang her to attack her. Amongst colleagues, we laugh about it now, but there was a serious moment to it and it really shook us all.
When universities talk about impact, I'm not sure that these are the measures that they're talking about.
How many death threats?
We should maybe look at how many citations and how many death threats, because something really must have your research really must have gotten up the nose of, you know, people who are trying to uphold the status quo.
Absolutely.
I think it's a conversation that's worth having because, as we all know, you know, all academics now are expected to spend an increasing amount of their time on impact and engagement, and that's increasingly how the kind of excellence or not of our work is measured. Mm-hmm. But as we all know, you know, the internet is a pretty vile place at times. You know, particularly places like Twitter. I think many academics have probably been trolled, probably not quite to this degree. And universities don't really equip academics with skills and, you know, kind of debriefing psychological support to help them get through these processes. So, Sandro, we could clearly keep talking ICE all day, but we're going to have to wrap things up. So I'd like to go to a question that we ask all our guests. As you know, we like to think of this as a safe space. Do you have a dirty little archive secret you'd be willing to share with us?
Well, archives can be slightly boring places, but I once decided to use some archives that I didn't really need to use just so I could get admission to a very historic building. This was Trinity College in Cambridge, and the archives there are hosted at the Wren Library, which is a magnificent piece of classical architecture. And Trinity College is usually closed in Cambridge, so tourists can't visit. Anyway, I was, you know, doing some catalogue research one day and I saw that one of my more dull interests, which is the history of fish protein, a record came up at the Trinity College Library and I thought, oh, will I have enough time to look at this file? Oh, no, I should put it off. And then I realised, oh, it's in the Wren Library. And so I think I can get in because tourists can't usually get in. So there I was, I walked through the enormous grounds of Trinity College, got into the Wren Library, had the best sticky beak I could have, flipped through this, you know, minuscule file very quickly, said thank you and left, perhaps abusing the archival system a bit to get a good look at a nice building. I don't think they minded, though.
I hope you used the toilets in the Wren Library while you were there.
I hope you graffitied the toilets with hashtag peak nerd.
Peak nerd.
Thank you so much, Sandro, for coming into Archives Anonymous to chat with us today. To learn more about Sandro's work, you can follow him on Twitter at Sandro Antonello or visit his Flinders University profile.
So until next time, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees. And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith. This episode was recorded on Kaurna land in Adelaide and produced on Wurundjeri land in Melbourne. Kaurna and Wurundjeri sovereignty was never ceded, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to listen. Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com. And if you are new to our little nerd cult here, you can catch up on all the episodes of Archive Fever, plus a bunch of nerdy links and great photos on our website, archivefeverpod.com.
And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright or on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
And you can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees. Coming up on our next episode.
I think that's where the fever really struck me, was the potency. It was always potent. These documents, I've not received ever one document. Just the fact that we're recorded to me is, you know, such an obscene in the way that we're recorded by the state simply for being Aboriginal.